Hello and welcome to the West City Church podcast. If you'd like to get to know us more, find us at westcitychurch.com.au. We really hope that you're encouraged by today's message.
So today being Palm Sunday, I really sort of wanted to sort of think about, you know, Christ coming triumphantly into Jerusalem, being cheered by the crowds and, you know, on the back of the donkey and everything we know about the whole event. But I think about a Christ who was probably torn. On the inside, he knew what was coming. He's looking at this triumphant time of amazingness, and I'm sure his disciples were going, oh, all this rumours we've been hearing, it's not so bad, because look at the crowd, look at, you know, let's do a census, let's go and talk to people in the crowd and do a needs analysis and see what they're saying. But he knew what was coming, and he knew it was the ultimate sacrifice that he was going to pay. And despite through all of this joy and excitement, he'd do it again and again and again if situations were different, or if there was a sliding door moment, because that's what he'd come to earth to do for us. And so I think about my life and I think about, you know, the journey I've been on and how, for me, it's been an up and down thing with, I guess, not so much faith, but my journey, understanding who God is. And I herald back to my grandfather. He's passed away quite a number of years ago. And I remember conversations with him about faith when I didn't really know where I was at or what I believed or things like that. And one thing he said to me was, look to Christ and do that. And so that's what I've tried to carry through my life. The most well-known scripture by us and people not in church is John 3:16. And the part that says, whomsoever believes in me will not perish. When you look at the Bible, there's always, footnotes and there's asterisks. And I thank God that there's no asterisk that excludes anybody or that says, whomsoever except for or instead of, or if you haven't done this right, you're not part of it. That it's an inclusive invite to everybody, wherever they are in life, to come. And I thank God for that. So that's how I try to live my life, in this place of, you know, looking to Christ and trying to be that. I'm not going to be that, but I'm trying to be that so that I can position myself in a place where, you know, a few weeks ago, my transgender friend messaged me and said, hey, I'm having an operation. Can you pray to God that I'm safe and that things go well for me? Or my friend who's an atheist even saying, you know, can we talk a bit more about Jesus? I don't know if I really want to believe or, you know, but let's talk about it. So that's where I want to position myself, in a place where I'm open and inviting people like Christ would to say, come, let's have a conversation, let's have a chat about where you're at. I don't have it all together, I don't know it all, but let's do this together and walk together. So that's, whenever I come to communion, that's where I like to put my headspace, is look to Christ and try to be that. Thank you.
Nahum chapter 1, verse 15 says, look, there on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. And Isaiah 52, verse 7 says, how beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, and who say to Zion, your God reigns. This morning we're talking about feet, if you haven't picked that up. Interestingly, in Ephesians as well, when Paul talks about the armour of God, if you know it well, feet, it's feet that are fitted with the readiness of the gospel of peace. Just like these verses, how beautiful are the feet of those that proclaim peace. So the sermon series, as sort of Phil briefly mentioned, is Ashes to Hallelujahs. The last sort of 4 or 5 weeks, we've really been ramping up towards Easter, which is obviously next week. It's Palm Sunday today. Oh, sorry, I'm slowly getting there. If you're wondering why I'm huffing and puffing on the podcast, I'm just taking my shoes off. we've been, gearing up to get ready for Easter. Also, shoes off aren't even that big of a deal in the church. I'm just going to take them off. I'm going to keep my feet out and about for the rest of the time. not that it's that unusual, but hey, it adds to the effect. I will stop at the feet. We'll keep the feet, that's it. So yeah, we've been really ramping up for the death, resurrection, and the ascension of Jesus. We're really now entering the final week in anticipation for Good Friday that's coming. And, you know, we've had Theo, he sort of talked about the entrance into Jerusalem and really sort of talked about how Jesus sort of fulfills the sacrificial system, the temple. He really did what he said he was going to do, which was destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it again. Kathleen sort of looks through Mark and the gospel, the account of the crucifixion in particular, how it was sort of like an enthronement of a Roman leader, sort of like a parody version of that. Kelly sort of spoke on the time between the ashes and hallelujahs, where we have to just remain faithful, trust. He is the only one that can truly bring about the change, the resurrection life that we need and want. And then Kai, obviously, last week had the theme of the silver. So he had the unfortunate task of talking about Judas and that sort of supposed need, like necessity of betrayal that had to be part of the story and the sort of mystery and tension behind that. And even just trying to sympathize a little bit with Judas himself. And we could talk forever and ever all year long just about that final week of Jesus. There's so many sort of little events, pieces of teaching, so much stuff just in that final sort of week. Even in your Gospels, it's the majority of your Gospels will be the really that final week of Jesus' life. Out of the full 3 years that he sort of spent, it's that final week, and those particularly obviously that final weekend, that's of utmost importance. So this morning I'm talking about feet. I will get to John 13, which is the account where Jesus washes the feet of his disciples. And that's really what we're going to be looking at, really where we're going to end up. But before we get there, we're just going to do a little bit of groundwork. We're going to talk about feet and everything that feet are and the symbol that they are. I know it's weird, but it's what we got to do. Otherwise, we're not going to fully understand the story. So feet are actually, even throughout history, throughout cultures, they can take on sort of many different meanings, different things. In ancient Egypt, it's kind of hard to fully ascertain, but it was part of their alphabet, it was part of their hieroglyphics, it was one of the symbols. So very common to see, if you know, look at images of ancient Egypt and things, feet will be sort of all over the place, classic image of like a left foot. It can be sort of a stance of power and authority. Usually you would have to be wearing a sandal for that to be the case. Usually the feet are all, there's no shoes on them or whatever, but a foot can be sort of power and authority. If you place it over and above someone, obviously we're probably familiar with an image where there's a foot sort of almost crushing someone, and it's sort of that image of standing over and above. So that's sort of one aspect. Chinese culture, there's actually a foot binding. I didn't learn too much about it. Mahalia sent me a podcast. I didn't really listen to it, but they really elevate sort of beautiful feet, delicate, tiny sort of feet, and they actually even have a practice where you'd wrap up your feet with a bunch of ropes, really painful like stuff to restrict their feet growth for that standard of beauty, which, again, it's like it's feet. It's kind of weird, right? but before we judge, even in our modern Western culture, I really don't want to talk about it, but feet are objectified. They can be sexualized. There's a whole thing. So, you know, you can't shy away from it. That does actually exist even in our world, even today. And in our scriptures, actually. So anyone that knows the story, whatever Ruth does with Boaz on the threshing floor, which is very suggestive sexually, it's written as Ruth uncovers Boaz's feet. And that's, you're sort of meant to get what's going on there. So clearly there's something of that nature that's going on. You're probably familiar with Japanese custom, but some of you might even practice it, because I've been to houses, plenty of houses that do practice it. Removing of shoes before you enter a home, or even just sort of certain indoor spaces or whatnot. Does anyone actually practice that even now, like at their house, got to take shoes off? Yeah, it's a couple. I've been to plenty of homes where that's sort of the case. You take shoes off before you enter. In Hindu and like Indian cultures, feet can be sort of affiliated with spirituality and humility. So there's even like a foot touching, sort of practice where, if it's like a holy man or something, it would be like you would try and get a hold of that foot, like you want to touch that thing, you know, because there's sort of power or anointing sort of thing with it. It symbolizes something. And then you have the sort of Islamic, even Jewish sort of circles, which feet, if anything, I mean, they have that sort of scale of uncommon and common, or impure and pure, unholy and holy, and feet, really, if they're going to fall anywhere on that spectrum, would be on the unclean, sort of impure side of the spectrum. They had a practice, obviously, which is, you know, even now is a ritual cleansing type of practice where you'd wash yourself, your hands, your feet before you'd enter into holy spaces. So it's a thing. It's even now, I think, I don't know how we feel about feet. I don't know where we'll land, but I feel like, you know, even throughout histories and cultures, it's weird that there's this spectrum of they're either super important, almost like holy, divine, power, authority type status, or it's just full on like dirty, gross, you know, taboo, don't mention it sort of thing. And it kind of, for some reason, will swing either way. Even to the point of, you know, like a holy man in a Buddhist type of community, you would have so clean feet and their feet would be elevated as like a sort of almost holy, sacred part. And they would probably cleanse and wash them, and that would be that similar practice, but they're kind of doing it for the inverted reason of, because it's such a sacred part, they would cleanse it. Whereas a Jewish person, if they're entering sort of a sacred place, because it's such a dirty part, they would cleanse it before they enter the spot. So interesting that we kind of had some similar things, but just such a variety of, I guess, views and ways to approach feet and what they mean. Who's fairly familiar with foot washing? They've heard the story, been around church long enough. Most. Is anyone like fully like, what are you talking about? Why are we talking about feet? Is there anyone at all? Never heard the story? No, I think we're in pretty good company. Cool. Some people don't. I actually, and I don't know how often you practice foot washing, whether you've done it at all. I've only really done it maybe a handful of times in my life where I've instituted and tried to do something of foot washing. And there was one time where one of the people that sort of witnessed it, they just had absolutely no clue like why I was washing feet. They'd never heard of the fact that Jesus washed people's feet. They didn't even know why I was doing that sort of thing. So I never know. I just wanted to go through, discuss feet, get the weirdness out the way. Yes, we are talking about feet. They're all out and about. I actually would encourage anyone, if you want to really get involved, to take your shoes off and just sit, chill with me. We're a very relaxed church. Some of you are probably shoeless anyway. But join the fun. We're all talking feet. We're getting our feet out. So we all pretty much know that Jesus washed feet, right? In terms of there's a story of him washing his disciples' feet. That's what we're talking about this morning. Does anyone sort of know how many times in the New Testament it's mentioned, the act of foot washing? Like when the church practices it or disciples sort of use it or anything like that? Anyone have a guess? 37, it's a good guess. Anyone else? How many times sort of the practice is mentioned? Outside of obviously Jesus doing it himself? No, 37's a guess. It's actually much lower than that. It's just one time. Maybe two if you're sort of stretching it. But I do find it interesting because I love foot washing. I love, and like I said, we're going to get to this passage in John 13. It's one of my favorites, really, because it's impacted just me and what I believe about God, who he is, what I believe about Jesus. But interestingly, it's not something that comes up like heaps in the Bible at all, like ever again, really. I will read, so in 1 Timothy chapter 5, there is this, verses 9 to 10, where Paul was instructing Timothy about the church in Ephesus, how to do things. So he says, a widow should be enrolled if she is at least 60 years old, the wife of one man, well known for good deeds such as bringing up children, entertaining strangers, washing the feet of the saints, imparting relief to the afflicted, and devoting herself to every good work. And that's it. That's the only mention in the New Testament. Outside of what Jesus does for his disciples and to his disciples, that's the only other mention of the church taking on the practice of foot washing, washing the feet of the saints. Seems to be something that the widows commonly did in the community. But other than that, we really have no idea. We don't know how the church sort of used it, practiced it. You can go, obviously, then a little bit, this is just the Bible, early church I'm talking, you can go sort of 100 AD onwards, and there's the practice of foot washing appears and pops up, and they sort of is instituted in churches. But yeah, in terms of our Bible, it's fairly lacking, which I find interesting because, again, I find it really important. And I'm not even saying that it's, you know, lacking in the text to say that maybe it's not important. I just find it interesting that it's really not. We're not really commanded how to do it, you know, why to do it necessarily, on what occasions we're meant to do it. It just is something that Jesus does. It's also not something that he did and was known for. Like, he was known for healings and teachings and all these sort of things. It's not like it was written as part of the, when he went around preaching the kingdom, he practiced foot washings. It's not like that. You don't get the sense that it was like that. This thing, foot washing, was something that Jesus did once, on one occasion, on one specific moment, for his disciples. And again, we'll look at that in a second. And even then, that moment is only recorded in one of the four accounts of the night and the meal that they share and what is recorded. So even only one of them actually records it. So that's foot washing. That's feet in general, a little bit of the context of it. It does appear in the Bible a little bit. So in Genesis a few times, when Abraham's visited by the three messengers, that are like the angel of the Lord, it's a hospitality thing. So it does appear a few times. When they come, you'd come in, you'd offer them a basin of water so they could wash their feet. You got to imagine they didn't have decked out bitumen roads, pavement, brickwork and all that sort of stuff. Very dusty, very dirty, lots of travelling by foot. When you get somewhere, especially if you're going to stay for a little bit of time, you would want to wash your feet. It would just be an act of hospitality. Again, there's a couple of other times in Genesis. When the sons go back to Egypt, when Joseph is the ruler and they go back the second time to go meet their brother, again, when they're accepted into the house, all right, come and stay, you're offered water for your feet. That's what's mentioned. David sends word to his wife, Abigail, to make her his wife, a proposal, and in response, all the servants that are sort of sent as part of the message as the proposal, she washes all their feet as this sort of extreme act of, obviously it's a yes, but it's this extreme act of devotion where even probably David would be like, whoa, man, this chick's the real deal, like she just washed all the servants' feet. And then, of course, there is the Old Testament, which is really sort of, I guess, the big hunk of the backdrop to get your head around, which is just the ritual cleansing. Like, even if it was not just like this special act of holy foot washing, like, you got to imagine for these people, you would do it by necessity. Just wherever you're sort of entering a house, if your feet are all messed up, especially when you're entering the temple, the holy sort of space, there'd be water, there'd be a basin, you'd wash your hands, you'd wash your feet. So in Exodus chapter 30, it actually outlines this, the bronze basin. So the Lord said to Moses, "You shall also make a basin of bronze with its stand of bronze for washing. You shall put it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it, with which Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet. And they go into the tent of meeting, and when they come near the altar to minister to burn the food offering to the Lord, they shall wash with water, so they may not die. They shall wash their hands and their feet, so they may not die. It will be a statute forever to them, even to him and to his offspring throughout their generations." So for them, like, this is legit. It's a real deal. You can hear it there in terms of the death penalty being the thing. And all that really means is, especially by the time of Jesus, again, this was a significant ritual practice in Judaism, the washing of the hands, the washing of the feet, before you'd sort of enter a holy space for a holy moment. So they'd be well aware of that. As an idea, they'd also be well aware of the fact that you just wash feet all the time. It happens all the time. And it usually is the act of a servant. A slave would usually be dressed wearing a towel. Whenever you could avoid it, if you could avoid it, you would not wash your own feet. You would arrive somewhere and there would be someone that serves you and washes the feet for you. That's the sort of pictures and stuff that we are looking at. So by the first century, it was still a common practice. It was a central practice. It was still an act of hospitality. It was still something that, to show that you were a hospitable person, someone arrives, you would give them a basin, you would let them wash. Also, like I said, it was an act so low that a servant would commit it if you could. In fact, there's writings in the Jewish sort of first century around that time where you wouldn't even make your Jewish slave do it, at all costs if you could avoid it. You wouldn't get your Gentile slave to do it because it would be so demeaning that if you could avoid it, you wouldn't make a Jew wash feet. You would, if you were a child, maybe wash your parents' foot. You would, maybe if you're a wife, wash your husband's foot in terms of establishing that sort of hierarchy. That would be a thing. A master asking his disciples to wash his foot would be very uncommon. A disciple sort of washing the foot of his master just wouldn't be asked of. It would have to sort of be kept very much within those family lines. And then even then, it wouldn't be so much that a husband would wash a wife or that the parents would wash the children's. It would be to sort of reinforce some sort of hierarchical type of thing. So that's what we're looking at. That's the sort of practice we're looking at. It actually does come up even in your New Testament, even in the Gospels themselves. So Jesus goes to a Pharisee's house. I really wish I could talk about this story even more because I'm just going to read a little bit from Luke chapter 7. But it's a story where Jesus gets his feet anointed with oil and the woman cries tears onto his feet. She wipes them with her hair and anoints him with perfume. And I'm just reading from Luke's gospel just to actually get a bit about the practice itself, because there's a little bit of insight. But the story itself is amazing. And we're reading it from Luke chapter 7, but actually he's the only one that pulls it out of where it originally comes from, which is in that final week of Jesus' life. All the other gospels, when this moment happens, it's sort of directly before the night of Passover. It's only a couple days prior that his feet are anointed. But I'm reading for Luke's for reasons that will become clear. So it happens. He's at the house of a Pharisee as well. So this woman comes in. She's doing this act. Like I said, it's almost a suggestive kind of sexual act in a way, especially if you're crying tears and wiping the feet with her hair. To the point where the Pharisee is obviously quite sort of disgusted and, you know, what's going on, and asks Jesus sort of about it. And Jesus has to tell him the parable and says, say a man, you know, there's two men. One owes 500 bucks and one owes 50 bucks. And then the guy that they owe it to, he just forgives them both. You don't have to pay anything. Who do you think will love him more? And the Pharisee says, well, obviously the one that owed 500, not 50. They're going to love that act a lot more. And Jesus says, yeah, that's right. And that's all he sort of says to teach him about this moment of what the lady's doing. Then he says, he says to him, yeah, you've judged correctly. Then he turns to the woman, but he says to Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house. You didn't give me any water for my feet. But she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You didn't give me the kiss of greeting, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. And you didn't put oil on my head, but she's poured perfume on my feet. Therefore I tell you that her sins, though they are many, have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little. Again, I wish I could talk about the passage more and pull more out of it. But even just in his words, you can hear that clearly, like, there was a bit of an expectation of hospitality. When you arrive at someone's house, there's a kiss of greeting and, you know, even anointing if the occasion calls for it. And certainly an opportunity to wash your hands and wash your feet. This guy didn't do it, apparently. And Jesus calls him out and he's able. So clearly there's some sort of practice, and it's very well known that this is a thing, that foot washing is a thing, an expectation. This one's probably more common, and this one's the one that I think I really resonate with in terms of getting my head around the practice of foot washing and what it meant to these people in the first century. It's what John the Baptizer says, one of his phrases. It's quite common, quite well known, you probably know it, where he says, I baptize with water, but among you stands one that you don't know, and he's the one that comes after me, and he's the one whose straps of the sandal I'm unworthy to even untie. And again, even in that, I mean, you can't kind of hear two things. You can hear the insight into the foot washing practice again. I mean, clearly it's something that a lowly type of person would do. And to the point where John's able to just sort of use that image as sort of a bit of a metaphor and say, I'm not even worthy to do that, like the lowest of lowest tasks. It also gives you a little bit of an insight into the mindset of John the Baptizer, which I think is a mindset that, if we're all honest, or at least if I'm honest, it's definitely one that I have most resonated with. This is sort of where I have sat in regards to foot washing, is when I think about Jesus, it's this phrase of like, man, he is the one, and I'm not even worthy to untie his sandal, like, let alone wash his foot. I can't even, like, I don't even want to touch his feet, or what, you know, because I'm not worthy. And that feels like it's almost the right response. And it probably feels like maybe where a lot of us are this morning. Certainly where I have been, that feeling of unworthiness. I hope I challenge that this morning, and I hope that becomes clear when we read the account in John chapter 13, why that is clear. Because the reality is, and again we'll get there, you know, we feel we're unworthy to even untie his sandal, and yet he comes to us stooping down and actually washing our feet, and completely flips that whole sort of dynamic on its head. So that's the mindset of John the Baptizer. That's the one I resonate with. That's feet in general. That's the foot practice sort of as it is. Now I want to actually talk about John 13. We'll read that passage. Before I do, I just want to set the scene a little bit. Because this is the last meal that Jesus shares with his disciples. So, and like we said, this is the last week that he has on the earth. And it's a really important week. Lots of stuff happens. And this meal is one of those, like, really, really significant events. In a nice thick book called Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, who is written, I think it's Howard, it's Ender Shine. He's like a Jewish No, he's not. He's lived in England. He lived in Germany, sorry. But it's a big, thick volume where he goes through historical, cultural context of the life and times of Jesus the Messiah. And he has this really interesting section where he talks about all this, but he has this really interesting point that I've thought about and really does make a lot of sense and actually I think is quite true. But he infers that actually this is the first, the last, and the only sacrifice that Jesus actually offers himself, and the only meal where Jesus actually is like host of the meal. And what I mean by that is obviously, and we see it in the accounts, he's the one that says the blessings and passes out the cup and dips the bread and hands it out. And it would appear, I mean, you don't see it in the Gospels, certainly, that Jesus does this. He certainly goes to many sacrifices, goes to many, events, what are they called? Throughout the year, Jewish calendar, they have all their festivals and all the sacrifices and all the meals even. He was involved in many of them. But usually he would be a guest of honour, or he would just have rocked up and sort of invited himself. Even in his earlier years, I mean, the assumption is that his father dies, because we don't read anything about him. Even if his father died, even if he was the eldest next in line to sort of be doing something like that, they might have just skipped him because of the thing around his birth. Like, he wouldn't have been as legitimate as, say, an actual first child. And then there's the thing that he's in Nazareth, which is a super small village, so if there was ever a Passover, all these sorts of things, it wasn't really the households, it was like a full communal thing. It would have been a Pharisee or, you know, leader of the synagogue or something. So really, throughout his whole life and ministry, we never actually see Jesus sort of taking charge in the sense of, all right, I'm leading this meal, this moment, except for here. And the reason I think it's significant is clearly he actually really thought that this meal was significant, because he says several times, like, I've been longing for this meal, I've been longing for this moment, I've been waiting for it. He's warning them throughout the years, like, this time's coming. So he knows and he's aware. And he even actually, like, he's got a plan in place. Like, he sends them into the town and says, like, just find the donkey and they'll know about it. Like, come and bring it back, or, you know, go and find the room that we got to stay. And they just basically find the person, and it's all arranged. Because Jesus clearly is setting something up and really cares about this moment. And cares about the fact that he's hosting a meal and hosting a sacrifice. And I think there's many things that he does that he's communicating and teaching the disciples many things through it. We're going to look at one of them. But it's clearly a special meal. We even know that surrounding this meal on the way to Jerusalem, like the day before, Luke actually has an account where it happens during the meal. There's these arguments that they have. About 3 or 4 or 5 times the disciples argue about who is the greatest. Who's the greatest amongst us? And it happens a couple of times around this meal, at the meal and even days preceding the meal. And what would make sense to me is if they were actually thinking about who's going to sit next to you at the table. Like, if we're going to have a meal, if this is Jesus' first meal, his first sacrifice that they're going to experience, there's also this anticipation of, like, he's coming into Jerusalem and, like, the kingdom's coming and this thing's happening. They probably would have been thinking, obviously, about who will sit at your right and left hand at the time. But for them, that time's like they're living and acting the meal that, like, the kingdom's coming now. So they're also, like, on their way to Jerusalem thinking, man, who's going to get to sit next to Jesus at the table, like, at the meal, at his left and right hand? So I think that would actually be on their mind, that were jockeying for position. And another interesting point in the nice sort of thick volume that gives some context of it. So they sit, this isn't like a table like us, where you sit at a dining room table all nice and around the chairs and stuff. Like, they were on the floor, and the table was like a mat, you know, blankets and things. You'd set it out, and you'd lay down. You'd lay on your left side so you could pick food with your right. And it's a little bit hard to describe, but you can imagine, I mean, you know how you go to a car park and you park like on the annoying angle, and they all go in like that? It's like that. So you sit, the table is a horseshoe sort of shape, like a U shape. They sit around the table in a horseshoe sort of U shape. So big table in the middle, and you go around it. And then there's sort of an extension at the bottom, so all the food can get served and everyone can sit around. And the way that you'd picture everyone sitting in a way that makes sense to me is that at the very end, you'd have John, the disciple that Jesus loved. Then you'd have Jesus. Then you'd have Judas. And then you'd have sort of the rest of the table, and Peter would be at the end. The reason I think it actually is like that is because it actually makes some sense of some of the details in the narrative. You know how Jesus, like, calls out Judas, like, in front of everyone, and you're like, what? He just called Judas, like, the guy, the betrayer, in front of everyone, and no one seems to care, and he just leaves, and everyone's like, oh, he must just be doing some business or whatever. It would make sense if they were sitting the way that they were sitting, because he would have been reclined, Jesus, right up against sort of Judas to his left. And John, the disciple, being right there, probably would have overheard and seen something, and that's why he's able to write about it. But in regards to everyone at the table, Jesus could have very sneakily ducked some bread in, handed it to the guy to his left, and sort of whispered some words or said some words, not very well overheard by everyone else, and then he could have just left. That seems to be what happens in the text. He also, Peter, is the one that hypes up when Jesus sort of starts to wash feet. And it seems like it would be because if Peter is on the end, he'd be the first one that Jesus comes to wash his feet. So that's just a little aside, they're sitting on the floor, they're laying down. Also, their feet are there. So you're eating at a table and your feet are very, very visible. They probably cleansed before coming into the room to some degree, because it would have been the practice too. But still, they're around a table, their feet are very much there and exposed, and they're about to eat a meal. So I would want to clean them too. But that's sort of the sense, that's the setting that we get. They're about to eat a meal, it's Passover. Let me read from John 13, because this is where all the action happens. So this is verses 1 to 17. So it was now just before the Passover feast, and Jesus knew that his hour had come to leave this world and to return to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the very end. The evening was underway, and the devil had already put into the heart of Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had delivered all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from supper, laid aside his outer garment, wrapped a towel around his waist, and after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to dry them with a towel that was around him. He came to Simon Peter, who asked him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you'll understand." "Never wash my feet," Peter told him. Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part of me." "Then, Lord, not only my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus told him, "Whoever has bathed only needs to wash his feet, and he'll be completely clean. And you are clean, though not all of you," for he knew who would betray him. That's why he said, "Not all of you are clean." And when Jesus had washed their feet and put on his outer garment, he reclined with them again and asked, "Do you know what I've done for you? You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, because I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set an example so that you should do as I do for you. Truly, truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you'll be blessed if you do them." See, when Jesus gets up from supper, he's doing what is very normal. The disciples would not have overreacted. It's that moment in the supper just before he starts with the blessings and really starts conducting the meal, that someone, the host, would get up and they would get that basin and they would wash themselves, like their hands and their feet, because they have to. You have to cleanse yourself before you do this ritual, before you embark on this meal together. Jesus gets up and he takes off his garment and he puts on a towel, which again, it's the garment of a slave. He dresses like a slave. He doesn't wash himself, though. That's the big sort of twist. They're probably waiting and expecting, he's filling up the basin, getting ready, waiting for him to wash himself. And then he starts coming towards Peter. And that's where Peter sort of goes and probably clicks on to, like, "Hang on, you're about to wash my feet?" And you can hear Peter's disgust. I mean, he's very clearly, like, showing the first century sort of, this is a lowly, disgusting sort of task. He can't even fathom that Jesus would do this. He can't even comprehend that this would be the thing that Jesus comes to him doing. But this is something that Jesus has to do. Like, has to do. And like I said, I think it's something that he planned to do, like really intended to do with meaning. And like I said, I really wish I could talk about the story again, because it was only 2 days before this, from most of the accounts, that he himself had his feet not just washed but anointed with perfume and oil. And I wonder how inspiring that was for him. Did he plan to originally wash the disciples' feet? And then that happened to him. He thought, now I definitely have to do it. Or maybe he wasn't even on his radar. And then this woman did what she did, and he thought, wow, like that's what an act. But this is something that Jesus has to do. And actually, if you reread this sort of thing, you can see how much it slows down, this passage. And you can, those first few verses, I mean, John's kind of like spelling the whole picture. Like Jesus, he knew who he was. He was coming from God and he was going to God. And John, he puts the foot washing thing, but in this whole context of like, this is it. Like this is the whole gospel here. This is God incarnate coming and doing like the servant thing of Isaiah, doing what he's meant to do. You could boil down all those little elements of the gospel story just in this sort of one little evening, in this one little package of foot washing. It's something Jesus has to do. Interestingly, this is another sort of interesting thing I find alongside the sort of he never really hosted a meal. Jesus, and this one's actually legit because we know it, because the gospels make a point of highlighting it. Jesus never baptizes anyone. He gets his disciples to baptize people, and John the Baptizer baptizes lots of people. But Jesus himself never baptizes anyone. And you could sort of ask why, and for whatever reasons and stuff. My assumption is just that if you were baptized by Jesus, well, a lot of people's assumptions is that those that were then baptized by Jesus would probably have some like higher status, and people would think like they were extra holy or anointed or something, because it was actually Jesus himself that did it. And so to avoid all that, he just didn't do anyone. Which could be true, but he doesn't do it. He doesn't fully immerse anyone in water baptism. But what he does do is wash their feet. And he actually says, like, no, Peter, if you don't let me do this to you, you have no part of me. That is like some chilling words, I think, and a shocking statement. This was something that Jesus had to do for us. Unless I wash you, you have no part of me. So this morning, it's really, I only have like two difficult questions for us that I really want us to reflect on and feel in this passage. And really, again, it's because I, if anything, sit on that side of John the Baptizer and of Peter. You know, I'm not even worthy, Lord, to untie your sandal. You're going to wash my feet? Like, no way, no way. And yet it's that exact attitude that will bar you. Like, that is what's going to exclude you if you're not able or willing to humble yourself and allow yourself to have your feet washed. You have no part of him. You can have no part of him. Because this is something he needs to do. He needs to be able to stoop down and wash your feet. It's actually a lot harder to do than it is to say. It's easy to say, yeah, I'll let you just wash my feet, sure. It would be a lot harder to experience that moment. And I actually encourage you, I mean, I don't want to talk about it too much because there's no point talking about my own sort of mystical experiences or whatever else, but I would encourage you to, because I sort of just tried it for myself a few weeks back when I was reflecting on this passage, have that moment where you really ask God, you sit down quietly, have your feet out even, and just actually ask God to just put me in this moment. Let me feel, you know, let me feel that what Peter felt. Why was he so like, this can't happen? What was going on in his heart, in his soul? Try and put yourself in that moment where Jesus actually, and like read those first few verses again, the one that comes from the Father, you know, this one that like everything is the Lord and King of all, and he comes and he takes off his robe and he's coming towards you and he's kneeling down and he's lifting up your soul onto his knee. That's God. That's actually the picture of God. We might think that God's coming in this like powerful, triumphant, mighty, coming to take over and, you know, pull apart everything that's broken or whatever else, and we'll miss what he's doing because he's actually just quietly taking off his robe, putting on a towel, lifting up feet and washing. And it's a blessing to do this. Like, it's that word, like it's a beatitude. Like when he says, blessed are the mourners, blessed are the poor in spirit, and all that. Blessed are you if you do these things. Blessed are you if you're a foot washer. Blessed are those that wash feet. And so my two difficult questions that I'm really asking this morning. The first one's fairly simple. And most of us would just say, yeah, let's do it. And that's, are you willing to follow Jesus' example of washing feet? Are you willing to stoop down? Are you willing to take someone else's foot in all the dirt and all the muck? And are you willing to wash it? And to that, most of you, I'm sure, would say, yeah, let's try and give it a crack, I would hope. And it's great. But an even harder question is, are you actually willing to allow Jesus to wash your feet? Are you actually willing to have the moment where you humble yourself and say, yeah, forget my feeling of being unworthy or thinking, this isn't something that I could surely receive, and actually just leaning into the embrace that this is who he is and this is exactly what he's come to do. This is exactly who he's shown himself to be, and what he wants to do for you is stoop down, take your foot in all its dirtiness and all its muck, take your life in all of your daily walk and all of the stuff that we pick up every single day, and he's not scared of it, and he doesn't, it's not going to shock him and turn him away. It's exactly what he's expecting, and it's exactly what he's come to do. Are you willing to let Jesus wash your feet?
How good was that message? Thank you so much for joining us. Each week at West City, we say a benediction together. We do this because we believe that the purpose of the church is to be a caring community for the world, and that as we go and serve others, we enter into Christ's work of welcome, restoration, and healing, both for us and others. We believe that in doing so, we get to see and encounter Christ. So let's say the benediction together. We come together as the church to be reminded of the go of Christ. So we will go out and feed the hungry, go out and clothe the naked, go out and fight for justice, go out and end oppression. Go out and proclaim anew the old, old story. Go out and associate with those who don't look like us, think like us, act like us, and don't even like us. And we'll do it all in the name of the one who sent us. His name is Jesus.